Welcome to Local Exposure, a podcast about music and the greater Cincinnati scene. I'm Jim Nolan. In 2001, Northern Kentucky's Pike 27 released their first album, Falling Down Hard, which gathered a lot of attention for the then-fledgling local band. Then in 2014, Calling Out, with its catchy pop melodies and infectious rhythms, solidified their reputation as one of the best live acts in the area. Now, Pike 27 has reinvented itself with the issue of their latest album, The Long Fight. The 10 tracks on this album showcase new arrangements and personnel, collaborations with great local talent, and deeper explorations in personal expression and social commentary. I had the opportunity to meet with Dave Purcell and Sean Riney from Pike 27 to talk about the band, the album, the stories behind some of the songs, and why the world might need Joe Strummer now more than ever. I'm in the studio with Dave Purcell and Sean Riney from Pike 27. Thanks for joining me, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Dave, there's a lot to unpack with this album. It's a new album, but they're old songs. It's a new lineup, but it's some of the same old guys. It's you singing, but now you're not singing. What's going on with this?
Right. It's our awkward adolescent phase, I think. Yeah, so the record... the record's been a long time coming. Some of these songs go back to the last version of Pike 27 from the mid-2000s. It was Sean and I, Mark Meserly from Wussy, George Cunningham from the Four Frenchmen, and Tommy Huseman, very good drummer, lives up in Columbus now. Some of the songs go back a while. The record, the making of the record took a while. During the making of the record is when I started to lose confidence in my voice. I started to lose interest in singing. The same time I fell back in love with drumming, that instigated that whole transition. Yeah, so the record's coming out at kind of an odd time, but I think we had a really successful release party at York Street with great crowd, great energy. And I think that felt like we had sort of graduated through this phase of, okay, the record's out to the world, but people know that there's a new lineup. We're still singing these songs, playing these songs. Dan is singing some of them. I'm still singing some of them. So,
are you still feeling that you're finding your footing with some of these, still getting comfortable with some of them, or do you feel like you're there?
That's a great question. I think the first few gigs, we were definitely finding ourselves a little bit. And it was weird for Sean and I because I've gone from being, to Sean's right on stage to being his rhythm section partner, and in some cases being his harmony partner to now he's harmonizing with Dan, and I have a very unusual way of phrasing and singing.
Yeah, I'd say we're definitely getting our footing. I think the CD release was an opportunity to feel like, well, some things have finally coalesced and get us excited. I mean, the sound is different. I mean, it's noticeably different if you've seen us before. And that's not a positive or a negative comment. You can definitely tell there's a new drummer. We're playing differently. We've got a singer who sings very differently and attacks Dave's songs a little differently, too. And I think it makes it unique. It certainly makes it interesting for practice.
The CD opening party, the CD release party, you played with New Sincerity Works.
Yeah.
So it was just a fun night because obviously they're a great band with lots of very talented musicians. And you make reference to the different sound. Let's talk just briefly about the lineup. Who is now in Pike 27?
Yeah, so Pike 27 now is I have moved from lead singer back to drums. I still sing about a quarter of the songs. Sean is still on bass and backing vocals. The original Mike Fair is still on lead guitar and all things Mike Fair. And then Dan Mecker, who most people know from the bands Denial and Queen City Radio and Turnbull ACs, wonderful singer-songwriter, very good singer, is now the lead singer.
Going back to the reference you made about the change in the sound, you've really gone from what I would call sort of a college rock kind of sound, like a throwback to, say, like an R.E.M. type sound, to much more of a straightforward rock and roll kind of sound, almost like a, maybe a Tom Petty or just roots rock and roll kind of sound.
Interesting you say that, because the band did start out as a very Americana, Sunbolt-y, Wilco-y kind of thing, and then went a little more pop, and I think the R.E.M. vibe came out quite a bit. And now I feel like, I'm interested what Sean thinks. It feels to me like we're almost in a little bit of a Kinks thing, where, the Kinks could pretty seamlessly blend amazing pop and country and English hall music and all that kind of stuff into something that sounded like themselves. And I would like to think, I'm not comparing us to them in quality, but I would like to think that's kind of where we are. We have, between the four of us, we have a core group of bands that we adore, and that's R.E.M. and the Stones and some other groups. And then we all have our favorites outside of that. And I would like to think we're now finding the way to blend all that stuff together. And what do you think?
Yeah, I think the bigger shift has actually been, I mean, when I joined Dave's band back in the early aughts, you know, it was Americana and roots, and I had never played that way before. I was from, you know, the pop punk culture, and had to learn how to play that. I had to learn from his first bassist, John Weisberger, who's an amazing bassist, you know, how to play alt lines. And what's funny is the songs that Dave brought into the fold over the last 2 to 3 years, which make up the bulk of the album, are the ones that, you know, sound like Elvis Costello, sound like the Kinks, sound like these sort of Anglo-influenced but very pop rock-centric songs. Now we're getting closer to my wheelhouse, and I'm excited. And so I play differently, and I think the bands started to play differently around those songs because of that. And even some of the older songs that are in there. I mean, The Long Fight, the eponymously titled first song and album title, is the oldest song, I think, besides Already Gone on the disc. It sounds completely different, and we play it differently now than, you know, than we did 6, 7 years ago.
I'm going to go ahead and throw the script out the window, because since we're talking about it, I want to play a clip from the album. This is the single Help Me Down. Because of all the songs, I think this is the one that sounds the most like the Kinks. Before we play the song, Dave, can you tell me a bit about the story behind Help Me Down?
Yeah, my wife and Amy and I were in Northern Ireland a couple years ago, and we stayed in the Bogside neighborhood of Derry. So Derry is also known as Londonderry, was the home of where Bloody Sunday happened in 1972 or 73. 20 unarmed civilians were killed by British police and British military. So it's really sort of a very central place for the Catholic IRA resistance. The Bogside is a working class Catholic neighborhood in the middle of Derry. Also the home of the great Irish rock band, The Undertones, just for the record. But there is a wonderful museum there called the Museum of Free Derry that it tells the Catholic IRA side of the troubles in that city. Our tour guide, it turns out, his name was John. I'm blanking out on his last name at the moment. His little brother was murdered that day by the British military. He was in his late teens, went to the protests just really to see what was going on for the first time with his friends. And was unarmed and was killed. So as this guy is now in his 60s is telling us this story, after we've toured the museum, for him to say like, oh, and by the way, my little brother was one of the guys on the wall right here. That's him right there. Just it leaves you speechless, you know. And I had this song where the dummy lyrics I was singing was Help Me Down, St. Peter. And I'm like, man, I don't know what to do with this. And shortly after Amy and I toured and hung out in Derry for a few days, and there's always, if you Google it, there's all these amazing murals of political prisoners and IRA heroes and that sort of thing. But immediately I was like, oh, that's what this song is about. This kid has gone to the pearly gates, you know, far too young, and has bands to play in and girls to date and pints to share and stuff. And so it came together pretty quickly after that.
Well, thanks. This is Help Me Down by Pike 27.
Help me down, St. Peter. I'm also picking up a little bit of Camper Van Beethoven vibe in that song. Is that purposeful as well?
Very interesting. No, I wouldn't have thought of that, but I loved them back in the day, and that's very interesting. I'm going to have to think about that.
I'm thinking about the album as a whole, even though the songs really span a broad spectrum of time. There's a whole lot of introspect and personal exploration in this album. When I was reading what you had sent me, some of the stories behind some of the songs, some of these must have been painful to write.
Yeah, very much so. I went through a lot of stuff over the past several years, good and bad, and I needed to write these in a way that I could sing them every night without breaking down. I still have trouble getting through Northern Star without crying. So I tried to place them either, I mean, even whenever I write about personal stuff, it's always, I try to put it in, you know, like any writer, try to put it in a way that other people can relate to it. So, you know, you try to universalize it, but also in some cases I had to really put it in the framework of another story or another character or another time in order just to distance myself from it a little bit, to make it less painful or less raw or whatever the case may be. Yeah.
Well, since you referenced Northern Star, you talk a bit about how the death of Joe Strummer affected you and how that sort of played a role in the formation of that song. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, I was going through an extremely rough time, and it was around the time that he died, and I liked the idea. So what Jim's referencing is the original title of Northern Star was Joe Strummer Star, and the idea was that I would walk around my neighborhood at night and think, I love the idea that Joe Strummer is up there somewhere in the world, you know, that I can stare up at the sky and think, man, come on, man, help me make things better. You know, Joe was a guy who went through some enormous problems, drug problems, alcohol problems, family problems, and came out at the end in a happy place. And then tragically died of a heart attack. But so I not only was him as a musical idol, but also a guy who had gone through some rough times and came out as a better person on the other side. So.
Well, and in the past year or two, we've lost some huge icons in music. You know, between Bowie and Prince, and like I said before, Tom Petty. You know, so somewhere up there, there's a hell of a band.
Yeah. And you mentioned Bowie. I mean, the story of me becoming a drummer again is a quite long one. But actually, Black Star was the last step in my wanting to play drums again. I was so taken by Mark Giuliana's drumming on that, and I yammered about it to anyone who would listen. And that was the final step of many that made me think I want to be in this tribe again. So Bowie, beyond the fact that I'm an enormous Bowie fan, that record has been huge to me over the past year.
Let's talk a bit about the production of the album itself, working with John Hoffman. Just knowing from other musicians I've spoken with and listening to many, many albums that he's had his hands on, I think one of the strengths of John Hoffman is in letting the musicians just be and letting the moment be and kind of letting things create themselves. But he still has this magic to him that he presents sonic moments beautifully.
Yeah, I think he's very fast, and I can't tell you, and anybody who's recorded in a studio can probably attest to this. Having someone who can work fast, efficiently, and almost effortlessly makes the process better, and you make the process better, you're going to end up with something you're happier with in the day. And I think that was John's greatest contribution, as we moved through, you know, initial tracking pretty rapidly, and that allowed us to spend more time on, well, how do you build this song? What do you add to it? What do you take away that makes it a better song? And so I think that's been, you know, the saving sort of the saving grace of working in a studio, in a big studio, and getting something done, is you had somebody who could move fast, effortlessly, and no pressure. And I think the fact that, you know, we've talked about it, we make, you know, fun of our age variation now. I'm no longer the young pup in the band. That's Dan's role. But working with somebody who's in his 20s, who's fresh, who's got a great set of ears, who works with a variety of different bands, I think that was fun too, because he wasn't afraid to push everyone, including Dave, to try something different, or try this, you know, this worked on, you know, this Gnarly Puppy album I worked on, or something, you know, and I think that was refreshing for all of us, and it was a good give and take.
Yeah, and despite his youth, his age, he does have the clout to back it up, because he's worked with some tremendous musicians and has created some tremendous albums.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't want, I mean, we have to remember Gary Schell was involved too, and Gary's sort of the patron saint of Pike 27. He engineered one of our first live gigs, and I think fell in love with the band, Dave's songs, and then of course Dave and Mike's guitar playing intertwined, and ended up, you know, engineering our release release date because we wanted him to be a part of it. But Gary, you know, rode shotgun for a lot of that and helped make some really big decisions, was really instrumental in when we were adding horns, when we were starting to layer things, helping us think through what that might sound like and what it might be. So having his ears in there, you know, was like having a fifth band member, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and I'm a little disappointed Mike's not here because he's not only a great guy, he's a tremendous guitar player, and I like being in the same room with him. But let's also talk about building songs. Let's talk about some of the collaborations that you had on this album. You, again, pulled out some winners on this one. You had Beth Harris from mm-hmm. The Perfect Children, who mm-hmm. just has an amazing voice yeah. and just brings so much. And then one of my favorites, Kate Wakefield. Mm-hmm. Her playing, her voice, there's so much there. And then Chris Comer on keyboards mm-hmm. or organ, I guess, mm-hmm. and then the horn section. Just tell me about some of these experiences working with these individuals.
Yeah, I think Beth was the first one thinking about adding. It was Sean's idea to add a female vocal to it, and we were playing a show just after The Perfect Children at Washington Park. It was the King Records thing, mm-hmm. I think. And we had been thinking about who might be able to sing it, and as they're playing, Sean elbows me and says, it's got to be Beth. And we asked Beth to do it. And I'm not exaggerating when I say we cried in the studio when she sang her parts. They were just amazing.
Mm-hmm. And that's a great example. So that's an older song, and it completely changed for me and how we play it and how I listen to it now, because now it sounds like a conversation between a man and a woman in a really cool mm-hmm. way, when it was all Dave's voice before, you know, and obviously we do it differently live, but I think that was part of what Beth brought to the conversation. She gave it a whole different sound, but also a different perspective.
With Kate, we had talked about getting her on the record. We didn't know her, though. We'd seen her play both with Lung and on her own, and loved her, loved everything about her. But we hadn't brought it up yet, and one day John Hoffman was, you know what would be really cool in this song is cello. I can call my friend Kate. And we're like, oh, who's that? my friend Kate Wakefield. Have you heard of her? And we're like, oh, hey, that'd be great.
Yeah.
And yeah, she came in a couple nights in the studio and was delightful. And she's her cello playing is great, but her vocals, there's a part where she's layering vocal over vocal over vocal. And there's like maybe five or six different parts creating this like choir on her own. And it was just mind-blowing to watch not only just the beauty of her voice, but the accuracy of John. She would say, okay, run another take. And she would, without even singing to herself, she would just bam, nail the next octave or the next interval mm-hmm. and the next interval over that. It was really remarkable to watch someone.
Masterclass in yeah. voice.
And she does that live in yeah. her performances, yeah. at least yeah. in her solo yeah, yeah. performances. And yeah, it's amazing to watch.
Yeah, yeah. The horns were cool. Sean arranged for the horns to come in. And the funny thing about that story was that, you know, these guys are all CCM dudes. Are used to coming in and playing the charts. And they came in and there were no charts. And they were like, well, what are we doing? And we're like, okay, on this part, we're thinking about something like ba-dum-bum, you know. And we would hum these parts out. And I think it took them a minute to get into the vibe of it. And we're like, no, we want you to co-create these things with us. We did that with Beth and Kate as well. We were like, we want you to create your parts to see what you come up with. We don't want to give you something to do.
Yeah, I specifically remember it was fun in the booth. We're like, what should we go tell them? They were warming up and they were going to start with the long fight.
Yeah.
We're like, what should we tell them like that? So I ran in and kind of looked nice. And I said, in the booth, we're thinking Muscle Shoals. And that was the direction. I mean, yeah. it really was, but it yeah. was great that they thought through, you know, they listened through a few times to do that. I think that was actually with everybody that contributed. There was very little, you know, there was some prompting, I think, by Dave. Well, this is what the song's about, or this is what I'm thinking. And then there was, you know, musical prompts by the rest of us. But they had the freedom to do it. I mean, we didn't spend lavish amounts of time, you know, to make it happen. But it was amazing what folks do. I think that's always such a reminder of what creativity exists just in our own little, you know, microcosm here of musicians that we get to work with. They were all, you know, a phone call or a text away from being on our album. And that's kind of cool that we could do that.
Yeah. What also impresses me is that you are able to take that step back and say, this is my song and a song that I've lived with for quite some time now, but I'm willing to kind of surrender a little bit of control and let you, like you said, co-create and let you add a layer to this. Was that difficult sometimes?
No, not at all. I mean, I'm a very collaborative person by nature. When I bring songs into the band, I will occasionally say this guitar part, there's a guitar riff that has to be played or you know, there's a couple songs I've written the bass riff for, but not many. I generally come in with vocal and chords and a melody and go from there and let the guys come up with their own parts. In this case, too, you mentioned Bowie earlier. I mean, it's a huge lesson I've learned from Bowie of, you know, the story of Bowie's career is surrounding himself with brilliant people and then letting them do their thing, you know, Iggy Pop and Brian Eno and Mike Garson in a room and see what they come up with.
Right. And that's the thing. If you have an Adrian Blue or a Frank Zappa in the room, you can kind of trust them to let things go. But then
that is our Mike Fair.
Well, there you go. If you have a Mike Fair or if a Kate Wakefield, you can kind of feel confident in kind of letting them explore and let them play. Between the first album and the current album, what lessons have you learned either musically or personally?
Oh, wow. That's a great question. Musically, I would say I'm editing less now. I still edit quite a bit. I'll live with a song for months before I bring it into the band. And my wife, Amy, is a writer, and she is my first line of editing and both lyrics and the song-wise. I think some of the ones on the new record I brought in with really What Do You Do at Night, Help Me Down, Northern Star. Some of these came in. I was like, okay, I have this idea, and it's not totally finished yet. I think I need to write a bridge or whatever, but I want to start on them. And I think that is the big musical lesson is to let go even more than I have in the past and trust that we're going to flesh this out together. Personally, wow. I think my first Pike 27 record, Falling Down Hard, came out in 2001 and was pretty political. And, it was the height of the Bush era and I was, angry young man phase instead of now I'm angry old man phase. But But I think I found a way to, through my teaching and through my work and through other parts of my life, to really, I kind of pick my spots with the political stuff now. And there's certainly political moments in this record, but it's really, Sean has talked about, my shift from the, big P to small P. And I think there's small P politics and big P personal stuff that now I'm just trying to write stories that mean something to people. And maybe somebody can learn something from them or be motivated by them or if they just want to turn it up loud and rock out, that's cool too.
And I can say objectively, having played the songs off the first album, for a number of years, I've felt that shift from the big P to the small P. And for me, that's kind of the ultimate gift when a writer starts actually being a little bit more personal and sharing it. When you notice it, when you're playing a song, you start to actually say the words and go, oh, wow, I think I understand what he's talking about now. And it's not a reference, to a political figure or something. It can get very intense. And I think some of that, I'm going to speak now third party objectively, but I feel like some of that's, mortality, getting older and the way you approach writing and playing. And I feel that. There's always this great melancholia vibe, I think, to Pike and to Dave's songwriting. And even, with Dan bringing his songs in, for the blend, which we're doing now, Dan's got the same vibe and is a much younger man, or not much, slightly younger man than me. And, and I think there's a touch of that. It's funny because we've been talking between ourselves quite a bit about the Automatic for the People reissue. And this, masterwork from REM had this twinge of mortality over it. And they were all in their late 30s experiencing that. And I think there's a piece of that I feel, certainly when I listen to the album and I hear it. Because I like albums that take me in both directions, both manic and a bit depressive. And I think it can do it in a really powerful way. And that's kind of the journey you want, right? Out of your full-length albums, if they still exist anymore, is a journey. And I feel that, I think, every time actually I listen to it and a lot of the times when we play it.
Well, it's funny you say that, because now that you reference Automatic for the People, I'm thinking, because it was preceded by Green, which I always thought was an incredibly overt political album. Mm-hmm. And so there's that same sort of progression that I'm the angry young man. Mm-hmm. And then as I mature, I'm going to be a little more creative with my words and maybe a little more poetic and a little less just volatile.
Yeah.
In referencing telling good stories, if it's okay with you, I want to close out with another song, and one that just has what I think is just a tremendous story, and that's $44.23. Will you tell me the story behind that song before we play it?
Yeah. So many years ago, I don't remember exactly when now, the Enquirer, there always have to be official witnesses when someone is executed by the state, and the Enquirer had, or it might have been the Post, I actually don't remember now, which shows how long ago it was, because the Post was still around, had one of their reporters witness an execution and is an official witness. And,
of a prisoner.
Yeah, of a prisoner on death row, Ohio's death row. And I was doing a lot of anti-death penalty work for Amnesty International at the time. But the thing that stuck out to me the most about that story was that the cost of the actual drugs that executed the guy was $44.23. And that just jumped out to me and stuck with me. And I wrote a song about it almost immediately, about this sort of a composite of some. I have actually met prisoners on Kentucky's death row before, and a sort of a composite of some of their stories of lost nights to drugs, of they don't remember, you know, sort of drifting around, sort of being on the fringes of society, that sort of thing, but all sort of centered around that fact of $44.23.
Well, this is $44.23 by Pike 27. Dave, Sean, thanks for coming in. Thanks for speaking with me. This has been great.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks for having us.
Best of luck to you guys.
Maybe a bus trip to Milwaukee.
Seven's new album, The Long Fight, is available for purchase or download if that's your thing. You can find links to do just that at wvxu.org/lx. Local Exposure is a production of Cincinnati Public Radio and 91.7 WVXU. You can find more great local music stories when you subscribe to Local Exposure at iTunes or Stitcher or wherever it is you get your podcasts. And if you'd like to leave a comment or a review on iTunes, that can help others find us too. I'd really appreciate that. This interview was recorded by Dave Shermer. Thanks, Dave. And produced by me, Jim Nolan. $44.23. $44.23.
Until next time.